heard saying something about having an Elder Helps You card right before making the flying long jump. I looked at Ilya. I think I squeaked. That was an elder? A real elder? Yes. He, well, the male who threatened you, was too close, so the elder pushed you out of the way. A light swat. Something one of their young would hardly notice. But humans are more fragile and... Is that why my butt hurts? It's bruised from a helpful whack? Yes. I tried to change positions, then sucked in a breath when the attempt pulled at my side. What else? One of his claws sliced you along your back and ribs. It's not deep, but it is a long slice that flapped your skin. It required some stitches. A lot of stitches, actually. You know what's worse than having one of the Terra Ingenie look at you as if deciding which parts to have for lunch? Seeing one of the Sanguinati squirm like he was stuck on a nightmare blind date. You bled some from the wound, he continued. I liked him so much better when he was lethal and scary. Some? Enough that Dr. Wallace decided a transfusion was prudent. Oh. Oh! Was that what he didn't want to tell me? So I got some... I touched my canine teeth to see if they were longer and sharper. Don't be ridiculous, Victoria. We're different species. Then... By the time I dragged it out of him, I was going to need a nap. It turned out Officer Grimshaw had the correct blood type. I blinked. Blinked again. You gave me Grimshaw blood? Ilya sat back and studied me. I realize I have a different view of human blood than you do, but I'm fairly certain that a transfusion of blood doesn't include a transfusion of personality. You never know. I could suddenly turn all stern and steely-eyed a percentage of days every month. I gave him my best narrow-eyed stare. An imitation of the mysterious heroes in some movies who rode into frontier towns to take on the bad guys. Ilya sprang out of his chair. That's it. I am calling the doctor. The medication he gave us for you is affecting your brain. I stared at the empty chair, open-mouthed, until Natasha walked out of the lodge and sat down. You shouldn't tease him, she said. He's been concerned about you. And that's an unsettling feeling since your kind are, she hesitated. Usually considered prey? I suggested. Yes. She looked relieved that I understood. The Sanguinati had their own reasons for helping me, for wanting me to run the jumble. They might look sleek and sophisticated. They might have learned to mimic human behavior better than any other form of Terra Indigene. But they were... and always would be, predators. And humans would always be their prey, whether or not they chose to be friendly toward a few of us. I tried to recall what happened when that last wave lifted me toward the shore and the lake elders released me to wash up alone. I checked my arms, then looked at the skin I could see without lifting up the tank. Problem? Natasha asked. I thought I would have some cuts from landing on the shale. Or the stones, or whatever you have on your beach. The elders told us they were bringing you to the lodge, and you were wounded. We went down to the shore to help you. Natasha grinned, revealing her fangs. When you washed ashore, you didn't land on shale. You landed on Ilya. I had full body contact with Mr. Yummy and wasn't conscious enough to appreciate it? How was that fair? I did not say that out loud. At least, I hoped I didn't. Just like I hoped Natasha had another reason for laughing as she walked back into the lodge. Chapter 81 Grimshaw Waters Day, Sumer 8th
Find anything? Grimshaw asked Hargreaves.
Samuel Kipp and the Bristol CIU team, along with Captain Hargreaves and the officers he'd brought with him, had spent the day searching for Vaughn.
It was possible the man had gotten away from the jumble. Not likely, but possible. The possibility was the reason he had returned after giving blood to help Vicky Devine survive her injuries. Serve and protect. That applied to fellow officers as well as the citizens of Sproing.
Not sure, Hargreaves replied. We brought in a couple of dogs, but something over there has them spooked. They won't go near the spot. I'll check it out.
Wayne, haven't you done enough today?
He had done enough. And if he had any brains, he would go back to the boarding house and get some food and sleep. But still my turf. I'll check it out.
He walked away before Hargreaves could object. In another hour, they would lose the light, and they were in a part of the jumble that was a fair distance from any of the buildings. That meant Hargreaves would have to call off the search in the next few minutes, and either pack up his men and head back to Bristol, or make arrangements to bring in supplies for the night and have the men camp out in the main house. Staying in the jumble tonight wasn't an assignment he'd want to give fellow officers. The pile of branches that were stuffed with grass and leaves made him think of a land-based beaver lodge. It might be primitive, but it was a structure, a dwelling.
Hello? Grimshaw called quietly. Anyone home?
No answer. An opening on the farthest side, big enough for a dog to enter, big enough for a man to enter on hands and knees. Something had churned up the ground in front of the opening. Either something being dragged into the dwelling, or someone fighting not to be dragged into the dark interior. Swearing to himself, and at himself, Grimshaw turned on his flashlight and crouched in front of the opening, focusing the light on what lay in the center of the structure before sweeping the light all around to make sure there was nothing else inside. From the look of the wounds, Vaughn had been bitten by something extremely venomous. Maybe an adult could survive one bite, if he received treatment in a hurry. But Vaughn's arms and lower legs were covered in bites. Could the Terra Indigene who visited Julian's bookstore have a venomous form? Or was this something else that humans hadn't seen yet?
Crap!
Telling himself he was every kind of fool, Grimshaw crawled into the dwelling far enough to touch Vaughn's wrist and confirm there was no pulse. Then he held a hand close to Vaughn's nose and mouth. No feel of breath. Nothing more he could do. As he started to back out of the dwelling, the light revealed three objects half hidden under the body. He stared, chilled by the implications. He should not disturb a crime scene. He should not remove evidence. He weighed procedure against the promise to serve and protect. If people found out about this, it might cause a panic that would sweep through the village, and that would stir up a shitstorm of trouble all around this lake. He would, of course, tell Hargreaves what he suspected. But later. He would tell Julian, and Ilya Sanguinati, on the odd chance that the vampire didn't already know. And he would tell Vicky Devine. Taking the three objects, Grimshaw backed out of the dwelling and breathed a sigh of relief when he was able to stand.
Found him, he shouted. Alive?
Hargreaves shouted back.
No.
As he waited for Hargreaves, Samuel Kipp, and the CIU team to reach him, Grimshaw slipped the three chunks of carrot into his pocket. Chapter 82. Grimshaw. Moonsday, Sumer 10th. The courtroom was in the government building next to the police station. A village of fewer than 300 people didn't need its own judge, so judges from Bristol and Woo Woo Crystalton alternated holding court once a week in Sproing, and most of the time those men sat around chatting with government officials or reading a book. Not today. The only thing in the human's favor was the Bristol judge wasn't wearing a particular tie clip, unlike the attorney who came in from Hubney to represent Dane and the widows of his business partners. And York Dane didn't look happy when he noticed that little detail.
But as York and Constance, Trina, Pamela, and Heidi stood before the judge, Grimshaw looked at Captain Hargreaves and knew how it would go. That's why he didn't look at the other two men, males, in the room. Had Ilya Sanguinati ever argued a case against a human attorney in a human court of law? In the case of Dane and Company versus Devine, York Dane's attorney had pulled out all the theatrical stops, playing to a non-existent jury, and making Ilya Sanguinati's calm responses sound lackluster at best, as if he was simply going through the motions and didn't care about the outcome and the judge's decision. But if the Sanguinati, if the rest of the Terra Indigene, didn't care about the outcome, why had the guy with the blue and yellow-tipped hair come to this hearing?
"To clarify," Ilya said mildly, after Dane's attorney finished his dramatic summing up of all the trauma that had been done to his clients. "Despite the harm and injuries that Victoria Devine suffered because of the actions of York Dane and the other members of the organization known as the Tie-Clip Club, there is nothing human law can or will do to punish the surviving adversaries?"
The judge was quiet and still for a full minute. Finally, he spoke, slowly and deliberately. "Mr. Sanguinati, neither you nor the arresting officers can prove that York Dane or the other people standing before the court today knew that Marmaduke Swin would abduct Victoria Devine. You can't prove these people knew that Tony Amarella would attempt to kill Miss Devine. Did Mr. Dane and his business partners disregard agreements that had been made with the Terra Indigene with regard to the property known as the Jumble? Yes, they did. But I think sufficient justice has been done in that regard. However, you did provide a convincing argument that the document Mr. Dane presented in order to repossess the property in question was, in fact, a forged document. Therefore, it is my ruling that the original settlement agreement between York Dane and Victoria Devine stands, and she is now and hereafter the lawful proprietor of the designated property." Grimshaw held his breath, waiting for Ilya Sanguinati's response.
"The Terra Indigene will accept your ruling about the land known as the Jumble," Ilya said.
"Of course you'll accept it," Dane said in a voice close to a whine. "He ruled in your favor."
"But recent events have brought a group of humans to the attention of the elders. And the elementals," Ilya continued. "And they have made some decisions with regard to these adversaries."
Suddenly, Grimshaw felt like he was standing next to a roaring fire. Hargreaves looked uncomfortable, too. Ilya Sanguinati did not. As for the guy with the multicolored hair, a chill went through Grimshaw as he considered why the room felt so hot.
"A few generations ago, a club was created in Hubney," Ilya said. "Its members were drawn from the private college, the university, the technical college, and the police academy. The purpose of the club was to form a pool of individuals whose various abilities would be made available to other members. A network, if you will. There is nothing wrong with networks, until they are used to manipulate other people in order for their members to take what doesn't belong to them. This particular club identifies its members with a distinctive tie clip, specifically the one my learned colleague is wearing." Ilya looked pointedly at the other attorney. Now Ilya focused his attention on the judge. "You have said that the human standing before you cannot be punished according to your law, or have already been punished since York Dane lost control of the land he coveted, and three of the females have lost their mates. As the representative for the Terra Indigene, I am authorized to accept that judgment. In return, you must accept ours. Beginning this day, and for the next 100 years, any human connected to the Tie-Clip Club, as it is officially known, is banned from Lake Silence, the land around it, and the village of Sproing. The ban includes anyone connected to a member of said club by birth or marriage. Any member of the club who crosses into forbidden territory will be killed.
Ilya looked at York Dane.
From this day forward, if any of you, or if anyone connected to you, tries to contact Victoria Devine or distress her in any way, or take any action that would damage the property known as the Jumble, a tight, intense tornado will form out of a cloudless sky and destroy your house and all that stands within it. It will destroy the building where you conduct your business. And it will also destroy the...
He turned to his companion.
What was it called?
Rutshack, the man with the multicolored hair replied.
I think humans usually use a more genteel expression.
Love nest?
Grimshaw suggested under his breath.
Ilya tipped his head. Yes, love nest.
Constance Dane turned on her husband.
You told me you hadn't renewed the lease on that place.
I didn't,
York said.
He didn't, Ilya agreed. He simply rented another one that you didn't know about. He successfully hid it from you. He can no longer successfully hide anything, because now we have reason to watch everything he does, and everyone he does.
Grimshaw fought not to smile. If Ilya had been looking for a fitting kind of revenge against York Dane, he'd found it.
If any of you go near Victoria Devine again, we will strip you, and anyone who helps you, of everything your greed has acquired, Ilya said. And then we will strip you of your skin, your muscle, and your blood. But not all at once.
The other man picked up a rolled newspaper from the table behind him. He smiled as he held it up.
And what the tornado doesn't take.
The paper turned into a torch that burned fierce and hot and quick, and the hand that held it was made of fire, not flesh.
I think we all understand one another.
Ilya Sanguinati walked out of the courtroom, followed by Fire, who dropped what was left of the newspaper. No one spoke. Everyone watched the last pieces of burned, blackened paper float to the floor.
Captain Hargreaves, Officer Grimshaw, the judge said, you will escort these people to the nearest railroad station and see that they get on the earliest available train to Hubney. I will remain here until you return. In the meantime, I will call the governor and let him know about this latest development between humans and the Terra Indigene. This court is adjourned.
Hargreaves made the decision of who was riding with whom, giving Grimshaw the three widows and driving York and Constance Dane himself. It was possible his captain wanted to give him a break and spare him from listening to the Danes snipe at each other. More likely, Hargreaves had made the decision to prevent Grimshaw from taking a very long detour into the wild country on the way to the train station.
Hargreaves knew him well.
Chapter 83. Vicky. Wednesday, Sumer 12th.
You're moving back to the Jumble tomorrow?
Julian asked, as we settled in the chairs on his porch. He had a beer. I had orange juice over ice, since I was still taking a nighttime pain pill in order to sleep. Yes, I'm going back, although I'm not sure for how long.
Why?
I hesitated. I went through so much to keep the Jumble. It was hard to admit defeat. The Jumble is kind of notorious now. Kind of? Newspapers from Lakeside to Hubney and all the Finger Lakes towns in between had written about the Tie-Clip Club's schemes and scandals and the Terra Indigene's retaliation against said schemes and scandals. The one good thing that had come out of all of this was that the club had been exposed as a group of wheelers and dealers who were, quite often, underhanded in their business dealings with anyone but their own members. I don't think it's likely anyone is going to want to rent one of the cabins and take a chance of being eaten, I finished. Or bitten by critters whose happy faces hid a different and very lethal form of Terra Indigene.
Do you want to know what I think?
Julian asked after a minute. Sure.
Yes, The Jumble has some notoriety now. And with the ban on the Tyclip Club members and their families, you're not likely to get the snooty crowd coming in for a weekend of summer fun. Julian leaned forward.
But ever since the story broke, I've been fielding calls from people who know people who were aware that I live in Sproing. Professors from the Finger Lakes universities, and not just the Intuit University. Writers and photographers who provide material for magazines like Nature. Even acquaintances from Crystalton who want to get away from home for a few days but don't want to go far. They all tried to call the Jumble directly but couldn't get through. I'm guessing your answering machine is full of messages. Since they couldn't reach you, they called me. And they're all asking the same thing. Are you taking reservations? Vicky, this is a Terra Indigene settlement that not only allows human visitors to be on the land, it allows them to interact with the others in a social setting. It's probably not the only place where that's possible, but I think it's among the few, and maybe the only one around the Finger Lakes. Think of it. You can swim in a lake ruled by an elemental. You can talk to one of the Panther Guard, or a bear. You can play a game of cards with a crow. People who want to study the Terra Indigene in order to understand what we humans need to do in order to survive on this continent are leaving daily messages at Let Us Read because we need places like this. I think we always did. And that's why York Dane's great-great-aunt built this house and the cabins in the first place. So that the Terra Indigene could learn about humans and we could learn about them. There are Terra Indigene living in some of the cabins. I can't ask them to leave. It's more their home than anyone else's. You don't have to ask them to leave. In fact, you shouldn't. Having a furry neighbor is part of the appeal. And I did mention that most of the cabins were basic accommodations with toilet and shower facilities in a nearby building. Apparently, when some of these people receive permission to spend a few weeks out in the wild country to do their research or take pictures, they're living rougher than that. They were excited and made it sound like having toilets and showers at all would be a luxury. And I'll give you one more reason for letting whoever is already living in the cabin stay on.
What's that?
Julian sat back and raised his beer bottle in a salute.
Somebody has to take care of the goats and donkeys.
Chapter 84. Grimshaw. Thaysday, Sumer 13th. After suggesting that Officer Osgood go out for a foot patrol, Captain Hargreaves settled into the visitor's chair in front of Grimshaw's desk.
So Vicky Devine is moving back to the Jumble today?
Hargreaves said.
She is. I'm taking a few hours personal time to help out.
Grimshaw cocked a thumb toward the windows.
Gershwin Jones is donating an upright piano in exchange for Vicky hosting a musical evening every couple of weeks. He figures it will bring people into his store for sheet music or smaller instruments. Might even encourage some of Sproing's residents to take music lessons from him. So I'm helping him muscle the piano into the truck and out again.
Not so much of a loner these days.
Still lack my space.
You did a good job here, Wayne.
Lost a fair number of people, he countered.
No one could have stopped that except the people who provoked the attacks.
Would have thought we'd all know better by now. But that wasn't the case.
Hargreaves said nothing for a minute.
The governor wants this police station manned again. He's been apprised of why it's been difficult keeping it manned, but he believes it's vital to have a police presence here now. With more visitors coming in every day, the area around Lake Silence needs a faster response than people can get by calling the Bristol station if they need help.
Can't argue with that.
Of course, the Bristol station will continue to supply backup. So will the police force in Crystalton. But they need a chief of police here, and one officer to work with him. Small place like this, two salaries are going to put a strain on the budget. But Silence Lodge has informed the village council that, if they approve of the people chosen to fill the positions, they will reduce the rent on the police station enough to help take the sting out of paying those salaries. The Sanguinati also said they would provide one of the Mill Creek cabins as a residence for the new chief, all utilities except telephone included.
That's generous.
Hargreaves studied him. Wayne, you're a good officer. A good man. But you're too damn ornery and independent to rise up through the ranks in the usual way. It's a big jump going from officer to chief, but I doubt an opportunity like this will come along again. That said, your temporary assignment is complete, and if you want, I'll put you back on the roster for Highway Patrol. You're being given the right of first refusal, so this is your decision.
What about Osgood?
Hargreaves hesitated. The higher-ups have some concerns about him, about whether or not he'll wash out as a cop. He's already requested a transfer from the Putney Police Station, which is clear thinking on his part. He'd be shunned by a fair number of cops there, and that's not a good working environment.
Yeah, Julian Farrow would know about that. Could Osgood stay here?
That would be the choice of the new chief of police. He didn't doubt that he could do the job and do it well. But did he want the job? Small place, where he'd know a lot more than he wanted to about the people he was sworn to protect. But there was also the wild country right outside his door.
Dangerous? Gods, yes.
And because it was dangerous, he could make a difference here.
I need to talk to someone before I give you an answer.
How much time do you need?
15 minutes, maybe 20.
He wasn't going far. Just up to the second floor. In that case, why don't I go over to the diner and pick up a couple of sandwiches? Grimshaw walked out with Hargreaves, then walked up the flight of stairs that led to two offices. He knocked on the door that had no stenciling on the glass that identified the business, and walked in. Ilya Sanguinati stepped out from behind the bookcases that formed the wall of his office.
Come in, Officer Grimshaw.
Ilya returned to the seat behind the desk. Grimshaw leaned against the bookcases.
If I accept the position of chief of police here in Sproing, will you have a problem with that?
He asked.
You, meaning me, the Sanguinati, or all the Terra Indigene who live in and around Lake Silence?
All of the above.
Then the answer to all of the above is no. We would not have a problem with that.
You okay with Osgood staying?
Ilya nodded.
You may choose whatever cabin would suit you for a residence, with the exception of the one already occupied by Julian Farrow. The rest are currently unfurnished.
Grimshaw shrugged.
I have an efficiency apartment in Bristol. I can bring what I need.
You should also be aware that Silence Lodge is considering offering 3 of the cabins for short-term leases. 3 months minimum.
Good to know.
It would certainly influence his decision of which cabin to claim for himself.
Is there anything you'll regret leaving in Bristol?
Wondering if that was Ilya's subtle way of asking about a lover, Grimshaw smiled.
I'll miss the pool hall.
Ilya sat back.
I beg your pardon?
Now he grinned. Pool is a game played on a felt covered.
I know what it is.
Ilya sounded grouchy.
I was just surprised by your answer.
Uh-huh. Couldn't be an easy transition going from the behind-the-scenes controlling power to having to deal with all the pesky humans directly. Considering his own job change, he felt some sympathy for the vampire, especially since that change happened by their own choices.
There is a pool hall in Bristol, just seedy enough to have character. I would go there on my day off and shoot some pool. Have a beer and a burger.
It was as close to a social life as he'd had in a while. Not something he would share with one of the Sanguinati.
I won't miss the establishment all that much, but I did enjoy the game.
None of the businesses in Sproing have a pool table?
Ilya asked. Grimshaw hesitated, then decided there had to be honesty between them, if nothing else.
There are a couple of bars in the village. Not sure if they're both open, or if one has odd hours, but the one that does regular business has a pool table in the back. But I'd always be a cop there.
Is that what you would call a deal-breaker?
He shook his head.
I just wanted to be sure we were good before I accepted the position.
We're good,
Chief Grimshaw.
And they would do some good,
Grimshaw thought, as he returned to the police station and gave Hargreaves his answer.
Epilogue. Vicky.
Julian had been right. The Jumbles' newfound notoriety might have scared off some people, and proved interesting to others, like the man who wanted to book a cabin in the hopes an elder would eat his wife and save him the cost of a divorce. I declined to take his reservation. On moving day, my office was returned to working order first, and they, meaning all the big scary males I knew, plus Aggie, parked me behind the desk with the pad of paper containing all the names and phone numbers Aggie had carefully written down from the humans who wanted to rent a cabin. Between returning calls and answering new calls and making notes so that I could ask Fred and Larry at the bait and tackle shop which weeks would be ideal for fishing in the lake, and asking Conan when the trout returned to the creek, information I assumed he knew because he'd chosen to live in one of the creekside cabins specifically to get his paws on the fish. I had booked all the available cabins into late fall. When I stopped booking humans into the more primitive cabins, thinking of how I would feel if I had to put on boots and a winter coat in order to go out and pee. I had a waiting list for the two suites in the main house and the two renovated lakeside cabins. The three universities in the Finger Lakes area solved their inability to rent cabins in the Jumble or rent rooms in Inikay's boarding house by renting three of the Mill Creek cabins from Silence Lodge on a year's lease, negotiating with Ilya Sanguinati to allow their people to explore the Jumble as part of the lease agreement. I remained the reader and, with Julian's assistance, continued to do a story hour three evenings a week. Gershwin Jones brought over a piano and a couple of drums, and we had a music night a couple of evenings a month. Hector and Horace acquired some ponies and ran a pony camp for visiting children. A couple of hours of learning how to ride combined with trail rides where the kids would see a hawk or a coyote up close. For people who didn't want to walk the trails in the Jumble for one reason or another, they could take a donkey cart tour and attempt conversation with whichever Terra Indigene was driving the cart and who couldn't understand what the humans were saying half the time. For reasons he wouldn't explain, Ilya Sanguinati purchased a pool table and installed it in one of the undesignated ground floor rooms, and asked Julian Farrow to provide the information for proper decorations to make it look like a pool hall. A few women grumbled about their men disappearing into the pool room in the evenings instead of spending time with them, but I ignored the grumbles when I noticed that our new chief of police stopped by a couple of evenings a week to shoot pool. Sometimes he wanted solitude and played alone. Sometimes he played with Julian, or even Ilya, who was learning the game. It felt strange to see Wayne, because when he was dressed in jeans and a t-shirt, he was Wayne, not Chief Grimshaw, looking relaxed, but it also felt good. And it felt good to spend time with Julian, to take walks and talk, and to go swimming once my stitches and cast were removed. It was toward the end of summer when a young Intuit photographer came to the Jumble, a friend of a friend of Julian's. Because of that connection, and because this was his chance to build a portfolio of nature shots, I introduced the young man to Conan and Cougar, who permitted him to take photographs of them in both their forms, something they hadn't done for other people who had been busy snapping pictures. He took pictures of Aggie, Josie and Eddie as crows, and the black and white outfits they had selected when I hired them to help me take care of all the guests. It worked out well. Smart guests gave them a shiny, inexpensive trinket. In return, you could count on those sharp crow eyes finding a guest's missing earring, whether it was under the bed, under a dresser, or in some other crow's stash of shinies. That day, the young photographer wanted to photograph the lake, and he asked me to go into the water. I demurred. I protested. I whined. But he was a pleasant young man, and maybe, being an Intuit, he had a feeling I needed to be in the water that day. I waded in up to my waist, and she rose out of the water right in front of me.
I looked at the photographer, who was staring at her and not quite daring to raise his camera to take a shot.
"He would like to take your picture," I said. "Is that all right?"
"Our picture," she said.
"I don't like having my picture taken." You couldn't explain self-esteem and body image issues to an elemental.
"Our picture. Then I will allow him to take one of me."
"Why with me?"
"So that you remember why it was possible for him to take the other."
He stood on the beach with the water lapping at his feet and took several shots of the two of us facing each other as if conversing. Then I moved away, and she turned to face him. As a thank you, he framed a copy of the photograph of me and the Lady of the Lake. He also gave me a framed copy of the photograph of her. He won an award for that photograph. It appeared on the cover of Nature and was part of a featured article full of photographs he took during his stay at the jumble. Those framed photographs hang on the wall in my bedroom. I look at both of them every day. I still wince when I look at the short, plump woman with unruly brown hair. Then I whisper, "You made the other one possible. Remember that." The other one. In the photograph of the two of us, she is this wonder, with sunlight turning water droplets into diamonds falling all around her. But in the other one, the one where she looks directly at the camera, she is power. She is lethal. She is the Lady of the Lake. If the elders who live in the lake were the inspiration for stories of mermaids, as long as you didn't get a good look at them, then she is the siren song that lures sailors into dangerous water and takes them down to a dark, cold grave. Her eyes hint of temptation, but it's that little bit of something behind her smile that warns you of what can happen if you give in to that temptation, if you're not careful. She can be friendly, but she will never be your friend. And she is the little sister to the elementals who live in the Great Lakes, and in the seas, and in the oceans. Challenge them at your peril. I don't forget, but I do swim most days while the water is warm enough. Sometimes Julian joins me for an early swim before he drives to Sproing and opens the bookstore. Some days I swim alone. Not really alone. She hasn't appeared to any of the guests since that photograph was taken. But when I'm on my own, I can sense her nearby. Sometimes see a face made from shadows in the water. And sometimes a dorsal fin will rise beside me, and the water's surface will be broken by the playful splash of an elder's tail.
This is Alexandra Harris. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Lake Silence, The World of the Others by Anne Bishop. This program was directed by Bruce Mann. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2018 by Anne Bishop. Production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.